Before I get to the text at hand, I want to read a portion of Paul's letter to Timothy. You don't need to stand for this. I'll call you to stand when I get to our actual text. This is from 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 6. I thought this would be an appropriate thing to begin with. He's speaking of the qualifications of an elder here. He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. So, the devil, he's the author of pride. He's the grand original, if you will. And we, in our flesh, are his offspring. And so, pride in us is rooted in his rebellion and our association with him, both by the fact that we are dead in Adam, and because we ourselves are living out that dead life in rebellion to Jesus Christ. So I thought I would just say a few things about demonic history. Some of this is speculative, but based on what Paul says to Timothy here, it's a good and necessary consequence, I think, of that verse to suppose that pride was the devil's undoing, and that conceit was at the heart of it. And how do we account for that? Well, this is what I think, for what it is maybe worth to you, and I think I'm right in this. He was the grandest of all of the angelic beings, and so he is a creature of enormous power, position, privilege. He knew that about himself because of the relationship that he sustained to the rest of the angelic host. What he did not know was what the plan of God entailed for him, and how it would be that he would come to fully know God and fully be like God. I believe the way in which that was to happen in the devil's case was as he served creatures who were made of dust. And so he would have looked upon man as a much lower creature than himself. And the idea that somehow he would be the servant of these lowly creatures, that he would indeed, in fact, lay down his very life for them, in order that they may be exalted. The idea of that stuck in his craw. He saw it as beneath him, and eventually rebelled against the whole idea and brought upon his eternal destruction, and of course the destruction of all of those who are in league with him. So pride was his undoing, related to who he was, to the majesty of his person, and the incredible powers that were given to him. And a failure to see that he was really being called upon to be like God, to relate to creatures in a servant fashion. His lordship was come to expression fully in his being the servant of dust, these creatures of dust. He could not feature himself in that role, and thought he was better than to be called upon to do that, and so rebelled. That's the take that I have on the devil and why he had to undo the kingdom of God, and what is really at the heart of his rebellion, namely his pride. We are told by John in his first letter that we are not to love the world, neither the things that are in the world, for all that is in the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but of the world. And so one of the things that's characterized in our rebellion, according to John, is the pride of life, which has to do with who we are and what we do and what we possess. Now, in thinking of the devil, the devil doesn't have flesh, right? He's a pure spirit. And so it may seem to us that there's some kind of a disconnect between himself and us, at least in this particular, that he doesn't struggle with the lusts of the flesh and the lusts of the eyes. But remember that the sphere in which the devil's person and works come to expression are this created order, in particular the kingdom of men, which he intends should become his kingdom, with himself as the centerpiece of it. And so, in the same way that it is true of us, that the present order is the stage, if you will, in which our being and doing, either as fallen creatures or as redeemed creatures in Christ, gets worked out, is true of him. the world is the stage in which he becomes who he is and realizes himself in his full potential as the Antichrist, the one who is against God. So he really and truly, literally, arrogates to himself the being and doing of God. And as it is true of him, so it is true of us who are his offspring, according to the flesh. That's really the heart of sin. It is to arrogate to yourself, to take to yourself, to assume the being and doing of God, yourself as a mere creature, so that reality is what you say it is. Truth is what you say it is. What is worth, what has value, is what you determine to have worth and value. You are God, and you think and act as God in the place of God. That's the heart of rebellion, the heart of what sin is. It's who we are in a knee-jerk way in our fallenness, and what our flesh is, even in those of us who are redeemed. That's our problem. Some background, first of all, to this text that I'm going to read you, which is the fourth chapter of Daniel, which is a lengthy text. It concerns Nebuchadnezzar, who is a classic example of the problem of pride, and who illustrates for us in his own life the consequences of pride and the consequences of failing to heed God's warning about the consequences of that pride. So, a few things about this king. A real person, obviously, who was on the stage of history between the years 605 and 652 BC. So, for a period of 53 years, he was the king of Babylon, which was a city-state and the most powerful and influential empire in the known world at that time, in the Near East. Babylon was his capital. It was a city occupying about 200 square miles, surrounded by a wall 56 miles in length, the top of which was sufficiently wide to host chariot races. So a virtually impregnable fortress, and of course boasting one of the seven wonders of the world, namely the Hanging Gardens. Now we come to know him because he is related to the people of God. And he is so because he is the instrument of God's judgment upon his people for their rebellion. So it is through Nebuchadnezzar that God's judgment, his promised judgment, finally overtakes his disobedient people. Daniel, who is the author of the book, the chapter, fourth chapter of which I'm going to read to you in a moment, is one of those who is taken in captivity during Nebuchadnezzar's first conquest of Jerusalem. And at that time, what he does is to take away all of the young men who are from either royalty or nobility in Jerusalem. So the cream of the crop, if you will, the very best of the best. Those who are physically attractive, those who are gifted, those who are intelligent, those who hold the greatest promise. He's interested in taking those people and grooming them to be his servants in Babylon, to work for him as King of Kings. And so Daniel and his friends are taken from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar in that first deportation in 605 BC. And we find something about the nature of their loyalty to Jesus Christ by how they relate to Nebuchadnezzar. And because they are to become his court officials, they refuse initially to partake of the king's food. Any of the king's dainties, the meats and the wine, would have been poured out. The wine would have been poured out as a part of sacrifices to their gods. Portions of the meat served would have been also offered as sacrifices to their gods. Daniel and his friends weren't willing to do this. And so rather than just out and out rebel, they said, well, why don't we try something? Why don't we do an experiment? We'll just eat vegetables and drink water, and you can look at us after 10 days, see if we look healthy like everybody else. And actually, as you know, they ended up looking healthier. And then, of course, we have the introduction, Nebuchadnezzar's introduction to Daniel, who is as a result of this dream that he has, we also find out a little bit about Nebuchadnezzar in this particular incident, because he has a dream and he's looking for the interpretation of it. He has court magicians, so these would have been his advisors, his cabinet, if you would. They were the people to whom he went for knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And of course, knowledge of the future was important to a ruler, because the more knowledge you have of the future, the more control you have. Knowledge is power. And so it was important to him to have people around him who could understand things, who had, as it were, an inside with whatever gods that existed. And so he didn't really trust these people who are in his court. And this is fairly early on in his reign, you remember. And so what he tells them is, I've had a dream I'd like you to interpret for me. And they say, well, tell us the dream and we'll give you the interpretation. His reasoning is, you know what? If you're smart enough to know what the dream means, it seems to me you probably are smart enough to know what the dream was. So tell me my dream, and then I'll know I can trust you for its interpretation. They say, well, you're asking the impossible. Nobody's ever expected this of any magician or soothsayer, sorcerer. Nobody ever has asked this. And he says, well, I'm asking it of you, and you better do it, because if you don't, I'm going to murder you all and destroy your households. So give this some careful thought. So this, of course, includes Daniel, who goes to Arioch, who is the king's advisor in all of this, and tells him, you know, this is a lost cause for all of us. Only God reveals dreams. But let us seek the Lord and see if he'll provide the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which, of course, he does. And so Nebuchadnezzar, giving credit to the Lord, shares the meaning. He shares, first of all, the dream itself, so that Nebuchadnezzar knows. He knows that, and therefore can be trusted with respect to the interpretation. And you're familiar with the dream, which indicates these four kingdoms, Nebuchadnezzar being the first of them, the head of gold, and the fact that all of these kingdoms ultimately succumb to another kingdom, which has a humble origin. It's a stone cut out of a mountain without hands, which rolls against these kingdoms and turns them to dust, which is blown completely away. And this stone becomes a mountain filling the whole earth, an everlasting, permanent kingdom. And so he gives the king this interpretation, and is thus promoted by the king, and occupies this position of advisor in the king's court, prime minister, if you will, the chief of all of those in his cabinet. And then, of course, we have that account, which I'll mention just briefly, in connection with Daniel's friends, and the fact that they are not willing to bow down to the idols of Babylon, particularly to the king himself, but only to the Lord, and are willing to forfeit their lives if need be. And so the king is confronted not only with the wisdom of Daniel and the fact that this man, for some strange reason, actually has access to the God who is in charge of things. And this God, who knows the future, is also powerful to save those who trust in him, as is exhibited in the salvation of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace. It's Christ, of course, himself who is present there. And so this is some of the background, which leads us up to chapter 4. And what I said by way of preamble concerning the devil sets the stage for what we have to say about Nebuchadnezzar and his pride and the consequences of it, and then also to look at ourselves and to see how this is also, in a measure, true of us, and what the cure of it is, how we can detect it in ourselves, and some of its dangers. Now, some things to note about this story. Once again, at the outset, the king's trust is in his counselors, his enchanters, his magicians, his sorcerers, his soothsayers and necromancers, not in Daniel. Daniel's the last person he calls in, even though it was Daniel and Daniel alone who could give him the interpretation of the first dream that he has. And Daniel's reaction when Nebuchadnezzar shares this dream with him is to be dismayed and alarmed. And he tells this to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, would that the dream that you had was true of your enemies and not you, my Lord. So Daniel sees something in Nebuchadnezzar. He's obviously one of his chief servants, his advisor, a man that Nebuchadnezzar looks up to. And so Daniel is familiar with all of the proceedings of the court. He knows this man and knows him well, knows his giftedness, knows his acumen as a military commander, as a politician, as a leader. He's sensible of all of those things and has regard for this man, though at this point at least he's an unregenerate. And so he is. He's truly dismayed and alarmed. And in part, perhaps, because he senses that somehow or other his own well-being and the well-being of the people of God are connected to this man and his rule. And what has been revealed to him is that that rule is about to come to an end, and that it's going to end for a period of time, though not permanently. And so what will become of Babylon when there is no longer this anchor for all of its dealings, namely the king himself? And so he gives the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar, having stated this, and having been brought into this awareness of his having been dismayed and alarmed. He tells him he'll be driven from men and dwell with beasts and eat grass, and will live an unsheltered life in the wild as a beast. And then he gives the king counsel. This is not just predictive prophecy. This is good counsel. He says, practice righteousness and show mercy to the oppressed. This is how I would advise you, given the prophecy which the Lord has made of you. Perhaps there's an opportunity, perhaps it will change. Perhaps if you do these things, God will give you a stay of execution and things will fall out differently. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar will have none of that counsel. And it's interesting at the very end of this story that he learns these things. He actually learns righteousness and he learns to be merciful. And he also learns humility. And they all reflect, they all echo what I think it's Micah says. What does God require of you, O man? But to love mercy, to do justly, to walk humbly with your God. Now these are the things which God is looking for in any person, but especially in a person of this prominence and position, namely the king. Though Daniel doesn't at this point deal with the fact of the need for humility. That's a long, long, long way off from Nebuchadnezzar at this point in his history. But 12 months later, he's on the roof of his palace and he's surveying his works. And he says there to himself, apparently, is this not Babylon, which I have created, which I have brought into being by my might and power, and which exists for the display of the glory of my majesty? So he's here talking. This is the story, right? But I said earlier, we arrogate to ourselves the being and doing of God. You see that in this comment of Nebuchadnezzar, his creative work, Babylon, the works of his hands, what he does, his doing, who he is for the glory of my majesty, who he is. Now, the only problem with all of that is that it's wrong. It's evil in the sight of God, because this is a mere creature and a sinful one at that, who is making such claims to himself, arrogating to himself in a very pronounced way the being and doing of God. And so the predictive prophecy, the curse, really overtakes him. And he is driven from men. We don't know for how long exactly, but for some period of time, perhaps for as long as 7 years, because his hair grows to the length of eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. I don't know, ladies, you grow your nails sometimes, hey? But how long does it take to get your nails as long as bird's claws? Quite a while, I'm guessing. In any case, he's given the mind of a beast and the life of a beast and the pasture of a beast. I want to make just a brief aside about this because you perhaps haven't ever thought of it before, but beasts have minds. They have hearts. They don't have the heart of a man. They have the heart of a beast. If you have a dog, you have a first-hand acquaintance with that. Because you know that your dog has, for example, a conscience. He knows the reason he hides when he hears you come through the door after he's eaten his way through your garbage is because he knows that he has done wrong. He has a value system. He knows the difference between right and wrong. You've watched your dog at the hearth twitching and groaning and crying out with his paws going because he's having a dream. You don't dream unless you have a mind. Images going through the dog's mind. Dogs have minds. They have hearts. They have a will. They have affections. They have thoughts. They are not men. They do not have men's hearts, men's wills, men's emotions. But they nevertheless have a heart. Nebuchadnezzar is given just such a heart, a beast's heart. So he goes from the very highest position that he can attain or that can be attained in the world at that time to the very lowest position. He's no longer on the top of a palace. He's on all fours eating grass. He no longer has the mind of the ruler of the known world, but the mind of a beast, an ox that eats grass. And he's held in that position for a long period of time, during which he comes to his senses and comprehends who he truly is and who God truly is, that he is nothing more than a beast because of his sin, that he is nothing more than a creature, the handiwork of the Lord, not the Lord himself, though he has pretensions to deity and has supposed himself to be equivalent to it. So he is recovered. He is restored. He looks up. He acknowledges that God rules, that he sovereignly rules, that his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, that he has power over all events, including who it is that he elevates to positions of power and authority, and who it is that he disposes or deposes, as he did here of Nebuchadnezzar. He acknowledges that God is right and righteous and that he is just. And then he breaks out into this paean of praise to the Lord. You've got to acknowledge the possibility, at least, of this man's conversion. You know, all of the ingredients certainly are there of it. It's not the sorrow of death that he experiences. It seems to be a godly sorrow, which brings about repentance. And we see that God blesses this man. He restores him to his place and makes him yet more prosperous in consequence. So at least it's possible. I think the evidence that's given to us here in this account suggests very clearly the possibility, at the very least, that this man was converted. Well, now some observations about humility in the first place. And, you know, in the Beatitudes, the Puritans always said this about God's work in the heart of man. The first order of business, always and only, the first order of business, humility. Humility. And that involves two things. Jesus begins with them in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. What does it mean to be poor in spirit? Purely and simply, it means to recognize who you are. You're a creature. You're not the Lord. You are dust of the earth. Your heart beats because he holds it beating. Your very soul exists because he holds that in existence. You're a creature. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Secondly, blessed are those who mourn. Mourn for what? Mourn about the fact that they are sinners and that all the troubles in the cosmos can be laid at their own feet on that account. And they are grieved by it. They're grieved principally for what it has done to God, their sins. So these two things are qualities which Jesus puts at the top of his list of blessed attributes in his people because they are the most principal work of God in the heart of man. Humility, a recognition that we are creatures, dust, and that we are sinners, that we are in revolt and rebellion against the God who made us, and have pretensions to get him off the throne so that we can get onto it. So these two things are essential attributes in the life of the people of God. And these are things which grow in us. They're not full blown when we come to Jesus Christ. They are works in progress in the heart of all of his people. He is bringing us into a deeper awareness of these things. We see, for example, with respect to an awareness of our creaturehood, what Paul has to say about that. He's talking about himself as a worker, an apostle, working for the establishment of the kingdom of Christ. And he's comparing himself with other apostles, namely the false apostles. And he says this, "I have worked harder than them all." It sounds like quite a boast, doesn't it? But then he qualifies it by saying, "Yet not I, but the grace of God in me, Christ in me." So what he has accomplished as an apostle, he attributes to Christ living out his life in him as an apostle. It's an acknowledgement of his creatureliness. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do nothing when I don't have Christ strengthening me. I can do nothing by myself. I am nothing by myself. Only in Christ am I something. And then an acknowledgement of his sinfulness. We see that growing, right, in the course of his life. He says, first of all, early on in his ministry, that he is least of the apostles. And later on, some years later, he says, "I am less than the least of all saints." So first of all, he's the least of the apostles. Then he sees himself as less than the least of all saints. So as he looks at the whole church, past and present and future, he acknowledges that he himself is the least of all the people of God. And then toward the end of his life, he goes down to another level, a deeper plateau, and says, "I am the chief of sinners." He doesn't even regard himself as the least of all saints, but the chief of sinners. In other words, if you look out there at the world and you look at mankind in its state of sinfulness and you look at the totality of them, all of the billions of them, I am the chief. He says this, folks, under inspiration. This is the work of Christ in the soul of man. This is an expression of true humility as it's worked out in the life of the Apostle Paul. It should be being worked out in our lives also. So, what is your view of your own person, of your gifts, and of your works? Can you truly echo what Paul says when he says, "For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever and ever"? Do you see yourself as the work of God? Do you see everything that you are and have as his gift? That he is the originator of everything that you have and are and can do. Paul reminds us of this when he says, "What do you have that you didn't receive?" Of his own, and that only, are we able to offer back to him. So we can take no pride in ourselves. We can take no pride in the gifts that we possess. We can take no pride in our possessions. All of these things come from the hand of God. Are you aware, are we aware, of our complete dependence on God? Moment by moment. How would you know that you are dependent on God moment by moment? I'll give you a very big clue. Your prayer life. If he's in charge of all things, and if you are utterly dependent upon him for all things, And he bids you to be praying always with all prayer in the Spirit. Because that is true, then you should be. Are you? Am I? Is prayer the heart of your life? Is it your pulse? Your prayer life is a proof of how much you suppose yourself to be a dependent creature. Now, you're not going to have to make a public confession to how far you fall short in that. But it is something that God is asking you and me to consider. How much of our life is spent in prayer? Especially when everything's going well. Because that's an index, you see, of who we think we are and what we think we have and what we think we can do. Our prayer life. Do we have an abiding, growing sense that others are better than we are? When you drive down the street and see somebody who is grossly overweight or derelict, in your heart, do you despise them? Do you look down on them? Or does your heart immediately go out to them? Are you immediately thinking to yourself, you know, as bad as that situation is for that person, I find myself in a worse one and see myself as worse? What is your apprehension of yourself? What is your apprehension of others around you? Can you take great pleasure in being last and least? I'm not asking you if you can endure it. I'm asking you, can you take great pleasure in it? Being at the bottom of the heap. So that maybe people you don't care that much for or about are on the top of the heap. Maybe at your expense. Can you take pleasure in that? That's an expression of true humility. Can you take great pleasure and steady purpose in being the servant of all? Can you see yourself in that light as being the servant of anybody and everybody? I mean, at cost. That's what service is, right? It's a cost. You have to do something or you have to spend something. Service involves sacrifice. Always. The two are hand in hand. Can you take pleasure in being the servant of all? Can you submit, I mean submit, in a thankful, perceptive way to Jesus Christ in the most perverse and pernicious providences? Can you say, your will be done? Can you say, Lord, this makes no sense to me, but you are the Lord, and what you do is good, and therefore this must be good, and I will submit to you in it, and rejoice in it, and trust you in it. That's an expression of humility. Are you thankful in all things? That's an expression of humility. Why? Because you're always on the receiving end. And everything, including the trouble that God sends your way, is intended to be a blessing and is an expression of His goodness to you. Are you content? Are you happy in Jesus with who you are, where you are, and what you've got? Really? I'm not. I spend the beginning of most days asking God for death. And that's the truth. Contentment. Are we content? Can we say, Lord, this is good. It doesn't feel good, but it is good because you've given it to me. Thank you for it. Help me, Lord, to trust you in it. Help me to carry on in it, to be productive in it, to be sweet in it, to learn from you in it, to take Jesus' yoke upon me and learn from him, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. Contentment. So those are some of the qualities, not all of them, it's not an exhaustive list, but those are some of the indexes really for whether or not we possess humility. Because if those things are true of us, even in a measure, then in a measure we do possess that grace, humility. On the other hand, there are also indexes of the opposite of humility, namely pride in the life of believers. Do you chafe at humiliation? Do you chafe at failure? Do you chafe at the state of affairs that you find yourself in and your station and status in life? This could be anything, your physical appearance, your circumstances. Is there anything that makes you unhappy, that chafes you? Do you have an inability to accept defeat and to lose well, or are you a sore loser? When you look bad, do you take it personally, or can you shrug it off? Can you look bad in the Lord and for the Lord, knowing how bad he looked in your place? Do you find you are displeased when others around you are advanced, especially when it's at your own expense? Do you take displeasure at criticism? Do you find you are unable to be wrong? Do you need to justify yourself? When someone points out a shortcoming, are you able to see that? Or is one of your strategies to point out one of your virtues as a compensatory self-justifying mechanism? Oh yeah, I failed there, but look at this. And so you mentioned some present grace as a means of offsetting somebody's barbed rebuke, criticism. Do you find that you are unable to really see and acknowledge the deep-seated and governing sins of your life because you have them? Or do you see sins in the abstract? I know people who can't ever talk to me without acknowledging that they are sinners. I know that I am a sinner. But when you ask them, what does that mean? For you personally, what does that look like? What is your sin? What do you struggle with? What do you see about yourself that you know that God sees as really evil? Tell me about that one. Tell me about those, not some sin in the abstract. I know people who can't because they have never been taken by the Lord through the veil of their own hearts to see their corruptions for what they are. They are hidden from them, and they resist with all their might and main seeing them. Are you easily wounded? Are you sullen and angry when you don't get your own way? You remember Ahab? You remember what Ahab did when Naboth said, no! He went home, wouldn't eat, lay on his bed, facing the wall, angry and sullen. Have you ever been angry and sullen? Of course you haven't. That's the response of a proud heart. That's proud flesh. You don't think Ahab was proud? Do you take offense when you're not recognized, when you're not valued, when you're not appreciated, when you're not thanked? Those things annoy you, irk you, get under your skin. Make you think perhaps that the next time it will be different. You won't be quite so lavish, won't be quite so patient, won't be quite so generous, won't be quite so willing to sacrifice and to serve. Those are all examples of pride in our lives, and if we're honest, we can see them all evident in us. And really, in a very astounding to an astounding degree, we should be able to see that true of us. Hopefully we can see the graces of humility being worked in us too by the Lord. Well, consider the Lord. Lastly, consider the Lord in all of this and why he bore what he bore. He knew who he was. He knew who his father was. He knew what his place was, obedience. And he knew what the end of things was, the throne. And that's why he could absorb such contradiction of sinners against himself, who deserved none of it. And instead of retaliating or justifying himself or unleashing wrath on them or calling upon his father to do so, blessed them, prayed for them, ministered to them, sought their good. Do you know who you are in Christ? Do you know who Christ is as your prized possession? Do you know what you have in him? Do you know where your place is in the present economy of things as his servant? And do you find satisfaction in it? And do you know what's ahead of you? The throne, the crown. It's all ours in the end. Well, he's really the focal point of all of this. If we want to be cured of our pride, if we want to have deep humility, it's him that we've got to fix our gaze on, because he is where it's at. There isn't any pride in him, and there's nothing but humility in him. Great as he is, he's the paradigm of it, and he's for us. And that humility which we see in him is our possession in him. It's part of what God is intending for us as he sanctifies us. If the Puritans were right, and I believe they are, the humility is the first work of God in the soul of man. It's all treasured up in Jesus Christ. And he is bent on bringing us into the possession of it, because that's what true blessedness is. Well, may that be our portion. And may we learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned. He learned it. He was blessed to have a God who loved him enough to teach him. He was brought down into the depths, from the very heights, from the highest pinnacle of glory. He was brought down into the deepest depths of humiliation, and then back up again, because he acknowledged that God was for him and with him in it. May it be true of us also. Let's pray.